Well, our second reading today comes from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 9, verses 30 to 37. They went on from there and passed through Galilee. He did not want anyone to know it, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, "The Son of Man is to be betrayed into human hands, and they will kill him, and 3 days after being killed, he will rise again." But they did not understand what he was saying and were afraid to ask him. Then they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What are you arguing about on the way?" But they were silent, for on their way they had argued with one another who was the greatest. He sat down, called the 12, and said to them, "Whoever wants to be first must be last of all, and servant of all." Then he took a little child and put the child among them, and taking it in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me." May the Lord bless this reading and our understanding today. Well, before I begin, I just want to extend a welcome to Jesse Orlana, who is here with us today. Welcome, Jesse. We've been praying for you and so glad to see you. Well, this week we return to Galilee. Jesus has been traveling in different places, some of them in traditional areas where the Jewish people lived predominantly, and others like Tyre, where they were just a small part of the population. But he's traveling along and he's trying to stay out of sight and teach his disciples. I say try, because continuously they seem to not get it. Well, we also see this week for the very first time, Jesus mentioned this word betrayal. Up until this point in Mark, the previous 8 chapters, that word betrayal has not appeared. But following this, we're going to see it more often. Continuing a common theme throughout Mark, his disciples do not understand what Jesus is trying to tell them. But as usual, they are afraid. They're fearful. And as if to highlight their misunderstanding, they squabble and argue among themselves over which of them is greater, which will be greatest in Jesus' kingdom. Can you imagine how Jesus feels at this point in time? He's trying to teach them and prepare them for the events to come, but they are self-absorbed and appear not to hear him. I wonder if any of you ever missed some important information that was given because you weren't really listening? I know I have. I'm sure we've all been in a classroom scenario where the teacher catches someone talking. And then she says, "Why don't you repeat back to me the instructions I just gave you?" And that person kind of slinks down into their chair, don't they? Perhaps we've been in the position as adults that we know we were distracted when some instructions were given, but we're too embarrassed to ask the person to repeat them. This seems to be the case here, because Jesus questions them about their conversation, and they remain silent. I can only imagine they were embarrassed that Jesus caught them. Well, in the silence, Jesus doesn't condemn or shout at them. He sits down, takes the position of teacher, and then he gathers the disciples around him. The teaching that he instructs them in is in 2 parts. The first is that he tells them whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all. And Terry did a good job of covering that in the children's message. This philosophy can carry over into other aspects of our life. For instance, when I was in the Air Force working as an aircraft maintenance officer in England, out on the flight line, we often would rotate our airmen into the chow hall in order to get food for lunch or whatever meal there was due. And all it was really was a makeshift setup. It had some hot dogs that were pre-cooked and some hamburgers, and they were in this metal tray floating in water under a heat lamp. That was good food. But it was what we had, and we ate it. But it was always our practice, the chief and I, to make sure that all of our troops had eaten first before he and I would go and get ours. And it became so ingrained in me that I have a difficult time now getting in line at potlucks until I see that everyone else has gone through the line first. And unfortunately, some of you are the same way. So we all stand at the back kind of looking at one another, waiting for the guy to go first. Well, there's actually a style of leadership that's based upon this philosophy, this approach of putting others first. Some of you may have heard of it. It's called servant leadership. How many of you have heard of servant leadership before? Organizations that practice this will sometimes present their organizational charts not in the typical hierarchical view with the boss at the top, but upside down. They put the worker bees at the top, and then every other level of the organization is under that, with the emphasis being that they support the true mission, the workers that are doing their jobs. It's a great reminder to everyone in that organization of what the most important part of their business is, whatever that may be. It's the people who get the real work done, the ones who make the products or perform the services that meet the needs of the customers. It's something that I've been in organizations that practice this, and it's very empowering to the people to know that they work in an organization that puts them first. Well, I wonder if any of you saw the news this week about a former television actor named Jeffrey Owens. He played a part on The Cosby Show, and it just so happened someone found him working as a cashier at Trader Joe's in New Jersey. Well, the powers that be on the internet picked up on this, the news sites and such. They got wind of it, and they made fun of him. They were job-shaming him for accepting a lowly position of a cashier, and the headlines were like, look how far this fella has fallen. We can compare ourselves to him now. Well, I liked his response to all the attention. He said, there is no job that is better than another. He said, it might pay better, it might have better benefits, it might look better on a resume or on paper, but actually it's not any better. You see, every job is worthwhile and valuable. I'd have to agree with him. It's one reason why I mentioned sometimes that to be the light of Christ in our daily lives is to show kindness and respect to every person we meet. Even if that's, you know, it could be the president of Penn State University, or it could be the janitor at Sam's. Actually, between those two jobs, I'd rather have the janitor job, I think. But throughout his ministry, Jesus associates with the last and the least in society. Gentile women. Jews weren't even supposed to speak to Gentile women. People that were sick, that others avoided. Lepers, raging demoniacs, tax collectors, and other notorious sinners. He even welcomes and makes room for little children, much to the dismay of his disciples. It's the small child that takes center stage next in this story. Jesus begins teaching with an object lesson. He brings a child into their midst, and while embracing that child, he teaches his disciples that to be a servant means showing hospitality to everyone, even the little children. And it was the children that were often seen as the least in society, both in ancient times, and I hate to say it, but in our times as well. And I think about how those disciples were behaving. Fearful, self-centered, argumentative. They were really behaving like children, were they not? And then Jesus brings this small child before him. And he says, this is how I want you to behave, like this child, innocent. At the very heart of this lesson is a simple message that discipleship means welcoming and caring for those that are of the least concern to others. Ministry in the name of Christ means giving priority to those that don't have any power, that don't have prestige or possessions, or in other words, those that can't advance us in any way in our professional standing or contribute to our social status or reciprocate when we provide them with material help. Today, children are among the most vulnerable in society. All you have to do is pick up a newspaper. Jesus is teaching them to welcome the children in his name. And furthermore, he teaches that when they do welcome the children, they're welcoming not Jesus, but God himself. Well, I imagine those disciples were pretty shocked. Later on, they even try again to prevent the children from coming to Jesus. And he once again rebukes them. That story is in Mark 10, verses 13 to 16. Well, the radical grace of God that Jesus proclaims completely turns around the world's notion of greatness. Greatness based on status, wealth, and achievement. Even the religious leaders, the ones that were supposed to be showing the example, felt threatened. So much so that they marked him an outlaw and a blasphemer and decided he was too dangerous and that he had to be eliminated. I stumbled on something this week that I'd like to share with you. It's something that really got me thinking some more about the basis of our beliefs and everything. One of the things that I've been perplexed by is some of my colleagues present a theological argument that Jesus didn't really have to die. It sort of stands the whole atonement theory on its head. But I want to tell you about it so that you can think about it. They say that Jesus could have accomplished his mission without dying, that horrifying death on the cross. And I've been skeptical of that, to be honest. But Elizabeth Johnson, a professor at the Lutheran Institute of Theology in Cameroon, put it in a way that it made a little more sense to me. She said it this way: it is important to emphasize that Jesus does not die in order for God to be gracious and forgive sins. Jesus dies because he declares the forgiveness of sins. In other words, Jesus didn't have to die in order for God to love us, to show us mercy, and to forgive our sins. Jesus died because he proclaimed forgiveness of sins and was rejected. That's something to chew on. She goes on to say that Jesus dies because he associates with the impure and the worst of sinners. Jesus dies because the religious establishment cannot tolerate this radical grace that God is presenting to them through Jesus. The kind of grace that Jesus lived out in his own life. And this is where it gets kind of serious for us. Are we resisting that grace as well? Are we resisting God's love and grace? Are we withholding it in judgment of others? It's much more appealing to be great on the world's terms than it is to be on Jesus' terms. It's great to be able to talk about how successful our families are, or our children, or people that we associate with. But greatness on Jesus' terms means humility. It means lowering ourselves and being vulnerable like a child. You see, greatness on Jesus' terms is risky. It can even get a person killed. But as Jesus teaches his disciples and us time and time again, because we don't listen, Jesus' way of greatness is the path to truth and life. Let us pray.